I don't care.
Yeah. A lot of people are snobs about these things. I'm really not.
I probably could not tell the difference.
I drink Miller High Life. It's better out of a bottle, but, you know, it's Miller High Life. It needs all the help it can possibly get.
Okay, well, if you need more beer, let me know. Today we've got Colin Delaney. He's a digital strategist and online communications consultant. Works for advocacy and political campaigns. We were talking that Brian and I have probably seen you around for the last, I don't know, 7 to 10 years, just sort of at events, and you're a man about town. And I know we've run into each other before, but never had the chance to talk this in depth, so I'm looking forward to this. You're also the editor of ePolitics, and I think that's what a lot of people know you best for, especially the Facebook list that you put out, the advocacy posts. Top performing.
What's the top 10? Top 10. Via CrowdTangle.
Who's CrowdTangle?
It's a company that looks at social media stats, basically. So this is a list of progressive advocacy posts that have outperformed the baseline for those pages. Okay. So it's not a subjective list. It's math.
And it's not necessarily the ones that have been seen the most, but it's the ones that are outperforming.
Yeah, the ones that are outperforming. Because if it's the ones that have been seen the most, it'd be the same 10 big groups every single time.
Do you see any trends? Like, do you see reasons why? Like, if you see something and you say, oh, this is going to make the list next week? Yeah.
Well, I'm always surprised, honestly. But the main thing is that it's content that is just perfect for that particular audience, right? And that's what works on Facebook. If you're running a page, you have to understand the people that are following you and what they care about. And then you have to put out something that pushes their buttons. That's what does it every time. As far as content types, I'm surprised that I haven't been seeing as much. I'm not seeing as much video as I would have expected now, right? Because Facebook is grossly overemphasizing video because they see themselves, I think, as being locked in a war. Well, locked in a war to take over the internet in some sense, but particularly with YouTube. So, you know, people that test this day to day, like Sean Dagan or Beth Becker, will tell you that a video posted to Facebook directly can get 10 times more exposure than a YouTube link these days. Same video, just Facebook wants you to post natively.
Yeah. Well, that's a good intro into our topic for today, which is audience segmentation. Mm-hmm. So basically, how do you reach the people that you need to reach? And so you've been doing a lot of thinking about this, obviously. how did your interest in this start?
Well, I can remember one of the very earliest posts on ePolitics.com way back in 2006 was, is the real online politics taking place behind the scenes? And it was basically that, you know, we can see things like websites. We can see things like social media. We can see to some extent people's emails, right? But we don't know the data targeting, data-driven targeting, the list segmentation that's going on behind the scenes. I remember with an Obama, I think it was 2012, email, someone like ProPublica tried to reverse engineer their list segmentation by getting people to send in variants of a single message. And they were finding, I think it came out because a husband and wife got somewhat different versions of the same email, even though they were sitting in the same house at the same time. So the reporter got very interested and they, you know, tracked down, you know, dozens of variations. But, you know, imagine that multiplied by 5 messages a day for 365 days a year, that the sense that there is a lot of the communication strategy is not taking place where we can see it.
Mm-hmm. You're saying it's taking place behind closed doors?
Well, it's often taking place, you know, in a hard drive or a microprocessor.
Or are you saying there is no strategy?
Well, in many cases, there is no strategy.
Yeah.
You know, obviously we get to a lot of this, you know, as we're talking today. But, you know, if you're able to get the right message in front of the right people, in theory, they're more likely to respond to it. That's what makes it right.
Yeah. So that's basically the definition, right? So why should we be concerned with audience segmentation? What is it?
If we want to spend our time well, right? If we have limited resources, which most of us do, then I can't imagine anyone other than, say, an Obama 2008 or 2012 that has functionally, you know, unlimited resources. We have to get as much bang for our buck as we can. And that means both time and money. Right. Mm-hmm. So if I spend a lot of time creating content, but I don't understand my audience well enough, or I haven't picked the right segment of the audience well enough, that content falls flat, doesn't go anywhere, then I have wasted my time.
You know, there's going to be a lot of folks that are listening to this that might have a smaller list, mm-hmm. right? Maybe they've got a few hundred or maybe just a couple thousand people on mm-hmm. there. What is your general thought on when's the right time to start segmenting? Is it a case of never soon enough, or you don't really need to worry about it until mm-hmm. you have something substantial?
Well, even if I have a 1,000-person list, I can still segment out people who've given me money, right? I can segment out people who have taken more actions than the average. I can segment out people who haven't taken any actions. I can segment out people who haven't opened an email in a year. And if they haven't, they're probably hurting my deliverability. So that's, you know, a piece of segmentation that can be really useful. There's the folks over at NGP Van have been doing a lot of work on deliverability lately, and a lot of nonprofits don't know that if you have a bunch of Hotmail or Gmail or Yahoo addresses that, you know, aren't opening your messages, then you are, you know, those big email sites are hiding your messages from a lot of other people.
Weren't you saying something amazing? Can we talk about the Convio stat that you had on your fingertips the other day?
Yeah, so that was actually related to the deliverability of advocacy messages mm-hmm. to representatives. Unfortunately, one of the things that has come out for Convio Illuminate folks is that their messages to their representatives were just not being delivered. It's one organization I was speaking with, they were seeing about a 50% deliverability rate. Hmm. And that's, you know, that's kind of disheartening, because then it immediately makes you think back, how long has this been going on for, right? How long mm-hmm. have...
So the first principle of segmentation is, can you deliver it? Will they receive it or won't they?
Well, that's the first... That's on the back end for the provider, right?
Yeah, there's a lot that can factor into that. Some, you know, some different advocacy solutions out there may deliver your message from one generic mm-hmm. source, or they may try to spoof and appear as if it's coming from the individual sending the message to the representative. Mm-hmm. So there is everything from that you have to take into account to the reputation of the different services as well.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's going to be a big factor. If you're letting anybody use your service and somebody that's spamming the congressperson mm-hmm. is sending those messages from the same server that you're sending your message around environmental or mm-hmm. educational issues, well, you're going to be penalized because somebody else was misperforming from that email mm-hmm. server.
Now, right? I thought a lot of these went through, you know, they're not even going through email. They're going through like a web form. And there's the whole Open Congress API thing?
Yeah, the API, there's mixed adoption there okay. In terms of folks that are using it. But actually, a lot of them, the dirty secret is a lot is still delivered via email right
okay.
now. There's only a couple that I know of that actually parse congressional web forms, which notoriously difficult to do just because they're all inconsistent and uh-huh. always changing.
So yeah. So we should take for granted that, number one, that you have a service that delivers your communication, and number two, that you have your list in some sort of a software package that allows you to do, you know, mm-hmm. queries and reporting, and so that you can divide your list. So what's the next step then? What how do you go about this, Colin? Mm-hmm. Like as a strategist, you're giving some advice to one of your clients, and they've mm-hmm. got, I don't know, 5,000 emails in MailChimp. What's the first step to get them to think about this?
Absolutely. Well, it's communications 101, right? It's what's your goal? You know, what are you trying to accomplish? What are you trying to get done in the real world? And then, does segmenting the list make sense to help you achieve that goal? Is there a way in which segmenting the list can help? You know, I'll just pull out a small example. Maybe you realize that you're not trying, or that you are not doing as well on Facebook. Your content isn't spreading on Facebook as well as it could. Can you identify people on your list who would be good, call them social media ambassadors, right? There are tools like Attentively that, if you have the budget, will go in and match your, you know, the members of your list to their social media profiles and help you identify the so-called influencers, right? The ones that other people listen to online. And then, you know, but there are other ways you can do it as well. You can also just ask people, you know, you send out an email. Would you like to be a part of our social, would you like to be one of our social media ambassadors? Mm-hmm. If you're a really small organization, you just look at who shares your stuff on Facebook, right? You identify them by hand if you're really small. But you give, and Beth Becker and I on May 21st are giving a webinar that'll touch on a lot of these things. By the time y'all hear this, it may be in the past, but perhaps we'll do it again. It's this idea that, you know, when Facebook is not showing Page's content to very many of their followers, right? You're talking 5%, 6%, 7% in a lot of cases. Then how do you cut through that? How do you actually get your stuff out there? Well, it's by getting other, you're either going to pay, right, one way or the other, you're going to pay in money to boost your content or to run content ads on Facebook, or you're going to get your people to do it for you, right? So that's a great, you know, great reason to segment your list. And
so the first step is to basically, there's some help out there in the forms of some third-party tools and services that'll help you figure out what's in your list and help you start to segment it, with the first goal being to identify your core supporters or your people who are going to repost stuff for you.
And if that's your strategy, right? Yeah. If you're trying to pursue this particular strategy. You know, there are other reasons you might do it, too. Donors versus non-donors are a great one. So, or small dollar donor versus large dollar donor, right? So I've got people who give $5. How do I get them up to 50? Or I've got people who've never given money. How do I get them to give some money? And even if you're not being quite that strategic, right? Say it's year-end fundraising time. I don't want to send a $10 ask to somebody whose last donation was $50. That's dumb, right? I will almost certainly leave money on the table. So can I segment my list by past maximum donation and try to send them something that's $10 or $20 higher?
Or should we digress into some tools? Because it sounds like finding that information out might not be the easiest thing in the world.
Yeah, there are a lot of tools to choose from out there. The great thing is that with any of these software solutions, the trend now is to offer free trials. So I am guilty of signing up for pretty much any tool that I can find and throw in my list or throw in.
What have you seen lately that's interesting? Man. Yeah.
Well, actually, you know, one of the things that I did just to check my own personal contacts list was I threw it into Full Contact, which is a service that a lot of these companies leverage their API to surface all the social media information. So I think Nation Builder, when you get the little profile card that says, you know, Clout Score, Facebook, Twitter link, that's all through Full Contact. So why not just go to the source and see if they have anything there? And you can actually do it against your own contact list for completely free.
So, interesting.
You know, I've got a few thousand people that I've worked with over the years, and I just threw it in there to see what my own list looked like. And there's nothing preventing you from doing that, though, with your organization's list, though.
What'd you find that surprised you?
Some family members, actually. I have a little cousin who I knew she was on Instagram, but she actually, I mean, she's like 14. And she has some better ratings than I'm willing to admit. But no, she's got a small following.
She's an influencer.
I guess kids like to bake, and she posts a lot of articles and photos across their different social networks about baking as a 14-year-old. So it's starting to surface.
Awesome.
And it's so strange. But yeah, that was probably the most surprising.
Yeah.
What are some of your clients doing with their lists? Anything? They're not doing anything at all.
No, actually, that's not true. I have one client in particular.
Not to be named.
Well, yeah, no, I'll tell you. What I'm dealing with a lot right now is these Salesforce integrations, right, where people have, you know, a mail tool.
Is that the Microsoft company, Salesforce?
Where they have like a mail program tacked onto Salesforce, right? And you know, Salesforce has some very, very powerful tools. Like, here's an example of one thing we're doing for somebody. They have done acquisition campaigns recently through a petition site, versus through a major targeted online advertiser in the progressive space, mm-hmm. right? So basically ran sponsored petition on one site, ran a ton of ads out on the web on another, in all cases trying to recruit people. So, you know, we're going in now and looking at the performance of these different groups in terms of open rates, action rates, that kind of thing. And then comparing that to the cost per acquisition to get the real return on investment for each of those channels. Mm-hmm. And we're still in early stages now, so I don't really even have hard numbers yet. I suspect the petition site, though, even though its names didn't perform quite as well, it was so much cheaper that it'll win on the ROI front. Mm-hmm. But that's, you know, that to me is a great use of that kind of data. Now, actually, you know, getting the data, you know, back and forth between the email program and Salesforce, the way Salesforce nickel, mm-hmm. likes to nickel and dime you on the data storage front and that kind of thing, it can be a real challenge. But you, but to me, that's a very fracture. Useful. It's a very useful use of the data. What did you say?
So then you got to call fracture.
Yeah, I know a lot of folks in this space that whether it's them or their consultants that seem to spend a majority of their day just data wrangling to try to get this information mm-hmm. and generate mm-hmm. those reports. And it seems like you know Salesforce tried to answer that call, but the integrations are always so spotty. And like you said, there's all these hidden fees in terms of what you're going to be paying per user, per application.
Oh, the number of API calls.
It's just incredible that there's still such a void to be filled in this space in terms of integrating these different applications rather than having to choose one as almost an all or nothing mm-hmm. and have all your information and data siloed and bought into that tool.
I got to tell you, the more I work with these things that connect one tool to another, I miss the integrated platforms. Mm-hmm.
So are you a lot of your clients doing this kind of sophisticated analysis?
Some are, some aren't. Yeah. I mean, my work spans the gamut. You know,
how common do you think that is in the nonprofit world?
Well, that's a good question. How do you define the nonprofit world, right? Because, you know, there are a lot of 1,000-person nonprofits, and they're probably doing a lot of this, right? But for every one of them, there are 1,000 one-person nonprofits who aren't doing any. Yeah.
Well, I don't know. I mean, a lot of the large associations that I deal with might not necessarily be doing
that's a good point.
Good of a job at this, and they've got the resources and the membership. They're mm-hmm.
But do they?
They're
do they
dedicated.
Have, yeah, I mean, even a lot of the big nonprofits, though, people get so stretched, right? You're in 14 different coalitions.
Yeah.
You know, it's always hilarious. It's almost like the little chihuahua thinking it's a big dog and mm-hmm. the big dog thinking it's the little chihuahua. It doesn't matter the organizational size. It seems to be the mentality of the people that work there mm-hmm. is sometimes completely independent of revenue funding, of staff size, mm-hmm. of resources and capabilities. You know, even working with some of the largest, nonprofits out there, and they're referring them, you know, to themselves the same way that the two-person, scrappy, yeah. No legal status nonprofit out of Milwaukee refers to themselves. It's incredible mm-hmm. How much, a change in a mental shift about, you know, where you actually are according to your peers mm-hmm. That mental shift can do a lot in terms of your productivity. But a lot of nonprofits, I think they're just, whether they truly are or aren't, they feel stretched thin. They uh-huh. feel overworked. There's probably a hint of truth to that across the board.
I think there's actually, having, you know, been internal at, you know, nonprofits over the years, it's very hard for a lot of them to say no, mm-hmm. right? That, oh yes, we'll go ahead and take this extra commitment on and this extra commitment on. Or they have a funder that pushes them to do it without, mm-hmm. you know, necessarily understanding all of the other things that the same organization is doing.
We'll pause for this. That's a much more satisfying sound than opening a bottle.
I agree. So
another vote for cans.
Plus their aluminum is highly recyclable.
So it sounds like challenges are capacity.
Another one, I've
inspired, you know, leadership.
Mm-hmm. And in some cases, you know, I've worked with either in or with several organizations over the last few years that these sort of long-term nonprofits, mm-hmm. things dating back to the 70s or 80s, that a lot of times still have some of the same staff and sometimes some of the same ways of doing things.
Yeah.
I was working with an organization about 3 or 4 years ago that the development team was used to doing things a certain way, right? they would, if they got a donation, regardless of the size, they were sending the person a letter.
They have a very complicated access database.
Well, they had a set of, there was a point where, let me see if I can get this right. Basically, the information.
It sits on a local file server.
We were coming in through Convio, right? So we would export stuff from Convio, send it down to them. Someone would print it out, walk it across the office, and enter it in to something else. And I am not. And then they would, even if this person was a $5 donor, they would want to send them a letter. They did not want us to build a small donor program because it was so time intensive down in development. But that isn't a good reason to not do a small donor program. That's a great reason to change the way you do things in the development department.
I feel like I might know the organization you're talking about.
There are a few of them out there. I was dealing with another one late last year, a terrific organization. And again, these are all great organizations doing great work.
They always are, aren't they?
Yeah.
They're always mission-driven, and mm-hmm. it's really, that's where the passion is.
But in this case, you know, again, they'd been around forever. They had 14 different databases that didn't, you know, communicate with each other. Their fundraising list was separate from their advocacy list, was separate from the list of people who got their print publications, and, you know, multiply that by a couple of times. And it became very hard. I was helping them out with year-end fundraising, and it became very, very hard to get the most. Yeah, we still doubled what they had raised from the year before. Thank you very much. But it was very hard to get as much out of it as they could have.
Yeah.
So this actually, you know, this kind of raises a good question, because before the podcast, we were just talking about the idea of segmentation and mm-hmm. targeting, and that probably one of the side effects of this is that you're going to want different content for your audiences, and that's going to take additional resources. So whether that's you or getting additional resources to help you out, unless you're the end-all be-all decision maker in terms of your day. Let's say you got to make a trade-off. You know, mm-hmm. you're needing to find time to actually create target-specific content for these different messaging campaigns. Mm-hmm. And you want to win over whoever your boss is and try to, you know, get them to buy into this idea as well, mm-hmm. Whether it's a testing period or what. What are some questions that I guess they could pose to their boss, or some scenarios that might open up the door to at least allowing a focused campaign that mm-hmm. actually drives different messaging to different audiences?
That's a great question, and this kind of question comes up, you know, all the time whenever you're trying to get, you know, organizations like nonprofits to change. Often the best thing to do is show them that one of their competitors is doing it, right? Because they know who their friendly enemies are. You know, the other organizations in the same space that often they've been coalition partners with for 30 years or whatever. Another thing is, you know, if the more concrete you can make it, if you walk in and say, we would like to micro-target, you know, that's usually not gonna do it. If you say, we want to reach this audience with this message to do this thing that will help the organization in this specific way, that's probably a lot better way to sell it. And then also test cases or pilot projects. Is there a way that you can try to demonstrate the value without spending a lot of time and money to do it? But as far as the content creation goes, I really try to think these days in terms of, you know, do we have recyclable content in a sense? Is there something that I can, if I have a phrase or an idea, can I express that in different media, right? When I was at one organization that was very wonky, they put out these Great Hill fact sheets, right? Classic one-page fact sheet, tons of footnotes, really, really good policy material, terrible for the internet, right? So we would take it and turn it into 20 different tweets, right? And then the graphic designer that we were lucky enough to have would turn it into an infographic. And then, you know, another thing someone might do occasionally would be to shoot 30 seconds of video talking to the issue expert about it just in the hallway, you know, so that you start with one basic piece of content.
That's our local fire department, which is right across the street. This will happen probably six more times throughout the show.
So what, do y'all just edit it out?
No, we just talk.
Oh, just keep going. Unless hey, the fire's, hello, Radio Land.
Unless the fire's actually in the building.
Yeah.
We're fine.
Well, I just always assume they're coming for me, naturally, so... Either to put out the fire or just to pull me in, whichever it takes.
You know, I've seen this cheap trick is what I'm going to call it being used. And,
great band.
Yeah. And I actually, you know, have anecdotal evidence to kind of back up the use of it just from some organizations I've talked to. But that is the simple idea of, you know, on Facebook, on these other different communications channels that allow you to post multimedia content, specifically images in this case. Just getting some free commercial use stock photography and throwing a quote on it, throwing a message on there. And the thing that really cued me off to this was a Catholic broadcasting radio station out in California that every day, like several times a day, they would just take stock imagery, random Bible quote, and post it. And these things were getting thousands of likes and shares.
It was like the inspirational post.
Yes, exactly. And it didn't matter what it was. It always got thousands of likes and shares. And then I started to see animal advocacy organizations doing almost the same thing, and you name it. It seems like one of those things that I'm guilty of it because I'm that person that's also liking and sharing all these posts when I see them come across my feed. But it seems like one of those easy ways that you could create content without, you know, actually adding much to your mental burden. You could, if you have, you know, 20 tips for X, Y, and Z, break those 20 tips out into 20 separate images and just upload them, you know, at your leisure to your different social networks.
But that's a little way that's, it's almost the opposite of the audience segmentation, because in that sense, you're just throwing crap out there that's easy to produce, hoping that something sticks.
Well, okay, so I have an idea for an article that I will probably never write, but it's called Mad Men versus the Robots, right? The old way of coming up with messaging was to put the guys in Mad Men, it would be guys always, put the guys in Mad Men in a room and have them come up with the perfect campaign, right? I think
we got that scenario right here.
We're pretty mad. But the other way,
you'd
you know,
be smoking cigarettes
is to come up with this. And I love to get interns in a room. You know, with you know, this is a thing that interns are great for is brainstorming sessions. You can use their creativity to your advantage. Come up with as many ideas as you can, and then put them out. Facebook is very good for this, right? Put them out and see which ones stick. You can learn a whole lot about what messages are going to work just by putting things up and seeing what happens.
Do you learn about the people who are looking at it too?
It depends on the platform you're putting it up on.
Okay.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting question specifically around Facebook and other networks that are now – basically once they hit a point in terms of scale and size, they start to – filter your content, right? Twitter was always famous for being the fire hose. You're getting the full stream just chronologically ordered, like it's up to you to catch up. And now they're filtering it because it's kind of...
To what extent are they filtering it? Do we know yet?
I don't think it's as transparent as some folks would assume. I know you can still switch back your feed to the fire hose listing, but I believe now the default is to very much like Facebook, the way that they're using whatever their algorithm is to try to, you know, say, hey, here's what you missed. Here's your recap. You can still go and see everything.
Oh, well,
but what's presented to you when you log in is a summarized recap of what you
interesting,
missed.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, sort of like that if you search a hashtag, you would get the most popular posts or the posts by the biggest feeds around that hashtag.
Whatever is recently trending.
Yeah. And they do, you know, they are sending those emails now, like the popular in your network. Mm-hmm. Which are occasionally relevant to me. So, no, well, I got on Facebook, I got on Twitter a long time ago and never bothered to segment out Twitter. So my default Twitter feed is functionally useless. You know, I'm following, I don't know, 3,000-4,000 people probably. And it's just, you know, anything, any single tweet is blown away in about 30 seconds. Where if I had been creating Twitter lists or something from the very beginning, but then that would have taken work. And that is the thing. You know, any of these kind of...
Well, do you have multiple Twitter feeds?
Oh, just the one. Oh. Yeah.
But I guess the question was, if these networks are going to be doing almost your targeting for you, one of the things we had talked about was posting almost the same message in a different form. So video, image, text, and essentially allowing Facebook to actually serve up that content to the audience that's most likely to engage.
I'm glad you brought that up. Yeah, no, I was at Roots Camp, New Organizing Institute's Roots Camp back in December. I saw a presentation by one of Facebook's Democratic outreach people, whose name I unfortunately cannot remember off the top of my head. But she was basically saying that you know, it's to your benefit to try to tell your story in different ways for different audience segments. So some people like images, some people like videos, some people still like text and a link. And Facebook knows, right? Facebook knows your particular pattern of interaction with content, and they're going to disproportionately show you content, the kinds of content you have interacted with in the past. So if you can do it as an infographic, you know, and then do it as a video, and then do it as, oh, here's text and a link, go ahead and do that. You'll reach different people. You know, another little trick is different times you'll reach different people. If you have a piece of content that performed really well during the week, one strategy is to rerun it on the weekend because it worked before, right? So you know it resonates with your audience, but you're going to get a different segment of your audience on Saturday.
That was actually something I was speaking with someone recently about, was actually resurfacing old blog posts that are still relevant.
Oh, yeah.
You know, if your website has a blog, you know, my suggestion was, why don't we look at just taking off the date?
Uh-huh.
You know, they don't need to know that it's from 2013.
Or, well, you know, what you can do is, you know, you can say, hey, look, this is an old idea that's still relevant. Just put a little italic. You know, actually, you've given me a great idea, because by now, ePolitics has been around since July of 2006.
We have going into syndication?
Over 2,000 blog posts.
Wow.
I have no idea what is buried in that thing. Now, these days, thank God, about two-thirds of the content is written by other people. But for those first, you know, 5 or 6 years, it was all me. And there is...
Sounds like a book.
You got a couple of them, yeah. Working on the... I have an ebook guide to digital campaigning that and advocacy that I'm in the process of rewriting. Any content site that's been around for a while is just going to have gems buried. And why not go back and say, hey, this is still relevant?
Mm-hmm. It'll give you opportunity to retag that content, which probably was ported over from some old CMS and doesn't have any text
or attached to it. Right now, you know, I switched over to a mobile-friendly responsive template and all that a year ago. The old content doesn't have the right imagery associated with it, right? So it won't share as well, you know? So now, exactly right, have a chance to repackage it in a form that will actually work in the modern communications environment.
So one of the challenges then is dealing with your social media's segmentation, and sounds like the strategy is to put a little extra in there, assuming that it's going to send it to the appropriate audience on your behalf.
But you can also target you can also do paid promotion, targeted paid promotion. So,
yeah, we haven't talked at all about paid promotion.
No. And Facebook, you know, Facebook boosting could be very subtle, you know, in the kind of distinctions you can make.
Well, maybe we should make a distinction between your audience and, you know, your supporters versus your universe of potential supporters.
That's a great point. Right.
So just for the purposes of this conversation, we're talking about basically you're at an organization, you've got a list. Maybe people follow you. Maybe you send them an email. Maybe you're in the donor database. But there's you're already, we've got your email. So what's the next step then? We've identified some of the challenges, which is the capacity and really the ability to customize that content sounds like the big thing.
Yeah,
is that right?
Just time. The time to be able to, time or money, which are functionally the same thing, to be able to produce. You can micro-target all day. Say I'm going to create 20 different segments, but if I don't have 20 different distinct pieces of content that I know are going to work disproportionately well for each of those segments, what's the point?
Yeah, and that's an argument. How do you make that argument internally? I guess you have to show some sort of performance based on all that effort.
Yeah.
Have you seen people doing that well or being able to justify that internally?
I think
those resources?
Yeah, I think with fundraising, it's particularly easy to justify, right?
There's a direct correlation.
Exactly. If I can show you that segmenting out my high-dollar donors from my low-dollar donors and treating them differently yields more money, or that segmenting out my non-donors and beginning a, like we talked about earlier, you know, trying to turn them into small-dollar donors, that can make a difference.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as, you know, the outreach goes, you know, the paid sort of promotion, Yeah, there are some fascinating options. I'm really fascinated by this concept of the Facebook custom audience, right? Mm-hmm. Which is where you take an email list and you upload it to Facebook, and then you use that as a targeting criterion. So you're either targeting at that list or you're targeting around that list, saying send to everyone but this list, right? Or maybe you're doing, and this is where I think it's really interesting, maybe you're doing lookalike targeting, right? And lookalike targeting is, you know, basically kind of a button that you push, and Facebook is pulling all of the data, you know, all the open graph data or whatever it is, basically all of your past behavior in Facebook factors into, in theory, factors into whether or not you look like the targets. I have a friend from Romania who's a political consultant who works around the world.
Those are our neighbors out there.
Out back. Hey, guys, bring us more beer. But he went into work a race, I think, in like Ghana. And the party that he was working for, because he was working for the, you know, one of the national parties, had an email list. And, you know, it was going to be disproportionately, of course, like downtown professionals, right? Not guys out in the countryside. But they could take this list of however many tens of thousands of people, apply lookalike targeting, and find, you know, thousands and thousands and thousands of potential party sympathizers. Wow. So you can go into a place that doesn't even have a history of online organizing. And as long as you can start from some kernel, you can use lookalike targeting to expand.
But you're basically saying, like, find me someone like this. You're not saying find me... You're not specifying what those
right, and when you get into cookie targeting, are. Yeah, when you get into cookie targeting, which, you know, there are plenty of firms out there that do it now. You know, on the left, DS Political and Precision, on the right, Campaign Grid, Zach Moffitt's firm, Targeted Victory, Rising Tide, which works with DS Political on the left. These firms are doing individual targeting, but you, as the ad buyer, don't know who the targets are. Right? The company that is serving the ads knows who they are, mm-hmm. but there's a firewall there, right? All I can say is, for instance, I want to reach women between the ages of 25 and 35 who do not have children and live in the following 20 zip codes. That's a targetable universe.
Mm-hmm. Wouldn't it be interesting to find your doppelganger? Like, who am I like?
Well, you could, yeah, I mean, you could do that.
If you shook hands, but the universe.
If you loaded just your email into Facebook's targeting and then said, find it.
Alas, I think it has like a 500 or 1,000 minimum.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Well, just you, all 5,000.
Well, with Twitter, you can do individual level targeting. Yeah. With Twitter, you can upload a list of Twitter feeds. Like, for instance, if I want to target every journalist in Florida, you know, if I can get their Twitter handles, and, you know, almost every journalist now has a Twitter handle, I can upload that and then target Twitter ads at those guys.
And, you know, the thing I like about that target, that lookalike targeting in Facebook is, the truth is, I really don't want a list that looks like my current list. I want a list that's better.
Sure.
And what I'm going to do is I'm going to upload my top performers, my top 10%, whether that's, you know, giving, whether that's, you know, action takers.
Do you mind if I steal that idea?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So go ahead.
Let's write it up. No, that's a great idea.
Yeah. I don't want more on my list. I want a better version of my list. And so I will take my top performers, I will bring them in there, and I will find lookalikes of them.
And see, I don't want to find my lookalike. I want to find the better version of me. Of me. And then kill him and take his life.
Yes. Yeah. What job do they have? Yeah.
So the webcast that you're doing, and I think this is our podcast is going to come out after your webcast, but it really deals with Facebook.
Yeah, specifically, yes.
And so that's on your mind as it... these days, as it relates to how are you going to go out and find your audience? Should we segue into Facebook a little bit?
Well, yeah, I mean, is
that getting off the beaten path?
I think we've been actually spending a lot of time talking about Facebook. So
easily a quarter.
I was curious more like how it works, like with the Facebook algorithm. And I mean, Facebook's changed so drastically. Just, I'm a passive consumer. I'm not a strategist or a, you know, I don't deal with it professionally. But I just know that it's so freaking annoying now because all the posts I get are just people reposting social media videos. It's not, I mean, if it was their kids, I'd look at it, but it's just some, they're just forwarding on crap. So I just get crap.
I don't see that. I see the same handful of friends over and over and over again on my front page. So it depends on who
maybe
you
have
are.
Nicer friends than I do.
I don't know.
Smarter friends.
I heard about, I forget who it was, but his own social experiment into fully embracing the Facebook algorithm was to like and share every post that came across his timeline for a week.
And was it someone in Slate did that?
Yeah, I think so. And it was like within a day, it said it's completely unusable in all brands.
Yeah.
So that organic content quickly, there's a fine balance between helping give indicators to Facebook and presenting content that you're going to want to see and going full brand awareness.
Well, yeah. I mean, in that case, he was what he was doing was, you know, the algorithm was going to misinterpret him.
Yeah, nobody does that.
So, yeah, no one acts like... No, he wasn't acting like a human being. but yeah, with Facebook, you just have to remember that what Facebook wants is for you to spend as much time on Facebook as possible. So everything that they do seems to be driven around maximizing your engagement. So your feed is full of the kind of content that you have interacted with in the past.
Oh, I hope not.
They just,
plus a lot of sponsored content, of course. Yeah.
And they just announced instant paper or instant articles yesterday, which allows folks like Washington Post, National Geographic, when you click that link, you never leave Facebook.
Is that a dangerous
thing?
I
don't even know if it's a web page. I'm not really sure how those pieces of content are constructed, but that's it. Facebook wants you to live
within
their
Facebook
platform. And really, their strategy at one point was to create their own Facebook phone, which was a complete failure. Mm-hmm. And what they realized was there's another way to become more pervasive on your devices, and that was to have an application for everything. Mm-hmm. You now have separate messaging application, separate Facebook application. They have the old paper application. So they're really trying to take over, just like Google is and Microsoft is, vying for your time and attention, which is becoming more and more limited. They're creating all of these applications, and because they're such a large company, they can try everything and see what sticks.
Right. No, they tried to kill email a few years ago, if you remember, that they wanted you to basically run
the inbox,
run, and that failed, thank God, because I said,
but the remnant is still that other inbox, which I remember to check every like once a year, and I'm but it'll be somebody that an old friend that reaches out and I can't talk to them now. It's been 9 months since they messaged me.
Oh, yeah. I do love that when I realize, oh, crap, somebody important emailed me 6 months ago and I just found the message. Great.
So if you're a digital communicator in a nonprofit and you're thinking about audience segmentation, what's the division of this much of my communication is in our newsletter, this much is in posting our blog, this much is our Twitter feed, and this much is Facebook? Like, is there a rational way to approach how you should spend your time across the various channels?
Yeah, again, I always come back to what your goal is, right? If you're, for instance, say Facebook versus Twitter. If your goal is to influence reporters, then you should be spending more of your time on Twitter. If your goal is to build up a grassroots following, you should be spending more of your time on Facebook, right? So that's a great example. If your goal is to raise money, then you got to build that email list, because social media, you can raise a little money here and there, but bread and butter for fundraising is email. Mm-hmm. So your goals have to set your strategy. I mean, again, it's just communications 101.
Okay. And then the second tier networks, Pinterest, all those guys, is there anything we should talk about there?
Well, it depends. Again, the thing with Pinterest, when I look at Pinterest and Instagram, and Pinterest, since Instagram has gotten so big, you don't hear about Pinterest quite as much anymore. The thing with, say, Instagram is that if you are an organization that produces a lot of imagery, Instagram is a great fit. But even there, what you're likely doing is posting to Instagram stuff that you built to put on Facebook, right? So you're seconding it over to Instagram. I've actually been reading recently some guides to Instagram activism, and there are some groups that are doing it, particularly like conservation groups, that have what we in the environmental movement called charismatic megafauna, right? The panda being the great example. Yeah, charismatic megafauna, baby. You need cute critters and cute kids, then you can do well on things like Instagram.
Yeah, sea turtles and panda bears.
Heck yeah, man. Oh, sea turtles kill. They're great.
I guess I would add that there's usually no cost to at least try new emerging social networks.
Except your time.
Except your time. You don't have to be that original, though. but the big thing is that usually new networks, because they need to get content, will promote content creators.
That's a very good point.
Better than older established networks because they have content overload.
Think back 10 years ago to YouTube, right? It was YouTube was good. If you had a video that was doing well, YouTube would promote it up. You know, now unless you're, you know, Funny or Die or something like that, you know, you're not likely to get boosted so much.
Mm-hmm. But if you go to a Vimeo or something where the it might be a little bit easier with the right amount of exposure to get yourself noticed.
I mean, yesterday I was actually looking at Periscope, the new live video service offered by Twitter to
compete
with Meerkat. It was kind of shocking how enjoyable the experience was. It was my very first Periscope was the Weather Channel, who was on the ground in rural Canada, like four of them in a van, videotaping and live streaming from a tornado about to touch down. And that was amazing. And I typed a message in there and she talked to me like 5 seconds later.
Wow.
And it was almost like, you know, FaceTime with a stranger, which isn't a new concept, but to have it so easily accessible and also the quality to be there.
What's the competing service again?
Meerkat?
Yeah. Meerkat, yeah.
I had some friends that watched the recent UFC fight on there rather than... or not the UFC fight.
The Pacquiao and Mayweather fight.
Yep.
Oh, so someone basically filmed the screen.
Yeah.
Of course.
Of course, right? They, you know, not in Meerkat's interest to shut that down at all. It's probably viewership is through the roof. But you think back 5 years ago, you know, systems would have crashed.
Yeah.
This thing's brand new out the gate and able to handle crazy volume.
Yeah, I'm curious to see because, you know, there was a little bit of chitter chat because I, you know, besides the advocacy world, I, you know, work in and certainly cover digital politics, electoral politics. And, you know, there was a little chitter chatter about the potential of a Meerkat election. I personally think it's going to be an email election, but that's just me, you know, with an email election with an assist from social media. How about that? We've had video streaming for a long time, live streaming for a long time. But you're saying the difference is the quality?
Well, imagine and the immediacy? This. You've got...
the ease.
Ease, okay. Yeah.
You've got a campaign. You're going to have a lobby day, people meeting with the representatives on the Hill.
Yeah.
And you're going to have an official account. Mm-hmm. And you can't make it. You're stuck back in New York. You weren't able to make it down to D.C. But, you know, every half an hour you're getting a little message on your phone, notification, live stream, they're giving you updates, you know, we just met with so-and-so, you know, here I am with so-and-so. You could actually participate, just like Twitter makes you feel in the moment, but it's stuck to text and links and images. This is just like Twitter, but it is, you know, the next level of communication.
Interesting.
So, like, I can imagine anything that you would use Twitter for seeing real-time information, disaster scenario, right? Tweeting this, tweeting that. How do you take that communication to the next level? Well, it would be seeing that person in real time. Nothing new, but just the delivery is pretty seamless and it works.
Well, and the delivery being seamless and it works can make all the difference.
Yeah.
I mean, I was on, like, when... Facebook was starting to come out, I was a little leery because I had been on Friendster. And Friendster was, if not the first, one of the very first social networking sites that took off. And the problem is, it took off. It was not built to scale well, right? So this probably was around 2004, 2005. If you tried to get on Friendster... after about 11:30 in the morning on the East Coast, it just froze. You could not do anything because it didn't scale. MySpace was built to scale. You know, MySpace had other problems. Facebook was definitely built to scale. So same basic idea, nothing really different. It's just they built it and it worked.
So what do you see ahead now? You talked about the next election being still an email election, but is there any hope for the technophiles that there's going to be some disruptive technology that's going to change the landscape?
You know, I've been asking that question a lot lately. I moderated the Campaign Tech East conference a few weeks ago. I moderated a panel with Brandon English from the DCCC, the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee, Katie from Facebook, Amelia Showalter, you know, some really, really smart people. The consensus was a lot of the same stuff we're doing, just better, you know, that you have 20 different data silos and they're able to communicate with each other. You know, that we get better about
big data.
Yeah, but not even so much big data, because so much of the time it's data you already have. You just don't know that you have it, or you don't know how to act on it, or you're not able to make the different pieces communicate with each other.
So the tools that allow you to visualize and integrate all of your data, so it's actionable.
And so, like, the Holy Grail, you know, the Holy Grail would be every single contact that I have with a supporter or a potential voter or a constituent if I'm already in office, every single contact that I have with them informs the next contact.
Yeah.
So what pages they click on in the website.
Like Salesforce without all the work of filling in all the forms.
I guess so, yeah.
And they have marketing systems that will do that, but usually cannot be afforded by most of the nonprofits out there.
Well, and you know, Ethan Roeder, who's been running the New Organizing Institute for the last couple of years, although he'll be stepping down soon. We were on a panel together, I guess, a year or two ago. He talked about the Obama data operation being held together with baling wire. You know, that it looked relentless from the outside, but on the inside, it was duct tape.
There's a little guy behind the curtain.
It was duct tape and baling wire, you know.
Actually, it reminded me, we got to get Dave Lykman in here at some point.
He's true genius. I love that man.
The Democratic campaign tech advisor out in Virginia. And he had a great post on ePolitics recently.
He's had several great posts. Every time I see Dave, I'm like, Dave, what are you going to do to triple my traffic today? Because every time he posts something, he triples or quadruples my traffic for a couple of days.
That wouldn't be hard for us. We'd go from 1 to 3.
No, Dave is a very, very smart guy and a very subtle thinker.
And Dave's down now at the Microsoft offices down by
Mount Vernon. He's digging it.
Yeah, and if you ever go in there, it's the future. You don't talk about technophile, you know, like transparent displays and 80-inch touchscreens.
Everybody's got Zoom media players.
I was at a conference in Paris about 5 years ago, and we went to the Microsoft Paris headquarters, and they had like the apartment of the future. And it was very much like that. Every single surface.
I remember the one in Austin where they had the big silky curtains.
But everywhere. In this case, they also had a very, very nice 5-string bass in the bedroom. And so I'm like, can I take this with me? And no, they would not allow me to take the nice 5-string bass.
So what we should do the podcast from the Microsoft office next time.
Yeah.
So Colin, let's get personal. Why are you so interested in this stuff? You've been doing this for a while. What keeps you coming back?
That is a damn good question.
You started out in politics, right?
Well, I did. Yeah. When I was all of about 22 years old, I stumbled, not through any, you know, design of my own, I stumbled into a job in the Texas legislature. And I worked for a member of the Texas House for 3.5 years.
So you weren't a political science major. You didn't
intern
on the Hill or not the Hill.
I was not
Austin State House.
I was not too bright. You know, I was not a directed person. I just sort of drifted into this.
Yeah.
But it worked out.
Sounds like my college career.
I mean, I think back to all the things I did wrong back then, of course, because I didn't know what the hell I was doing. But I think there are few better educations and how the world really works and seeing the inside of a state legislature. On a given day, I, you know, might spend an hour on the phone with a constituent who is having a problem with her landlord, and then turn around and write 2 lines of text that were going to go into a bill that my boss was, you know, talking about on the floor.
And you're 21 years old.
23 by then, but yeah. No, it's a terrific education. And then when I came up here, I had just started getting into coding HTML and the .com boom.
What brought you to DC from Texas?
Well, I was in North Carolina for a year in between, just kind of farting around, hanging around with a bunch of aging punk rockers, you know, and got bored to death. So
this would have been the early 90s?
96, 97.
So you missed the real punk rock boat by about 10 years, is that?
Yeah, these were the ones that were left behind in Raleigh, and let's put it this way, it was hard to get people to even get out of the house and come over and watch television, you know? It was not an ambitious bunch. So I got bored to death and had started, like I said, coding HTML, and a couple of folks I knew in Texas, one of them, my dad, had a couple of ideas for .com startups. And that was a .com boom, man. Anything flew. So the reason I have the epolitics.com domain is the first of those ideas was a legislative and regulatory alert system. Basically, brute force text searching the Congressional Record and Federal Register every day and sending people emails.
Wow. That brings back some memories.
In 96, 97. Yeah. Unfortunately, flaky programmer, the stuff never quite worked that well. And then by the time it started to work, things like Legislate and Roll Call were getting good. You know, they were catching up. Yeah. So that company never worked.
Why didn't you sell epolitics.com for $1 million in 1999?
Because nobody ever offered me more than $500. Are you serious? Serious, yeah.
Wow.
Now, that was around the time politics.com. The domain name politics.com sold for about $800,000.
Well, business.com, I think, was the record, as far as I remember, which was several million.
Yeah, but politics.com several times sold for ridiculous amounts of money. And then the company that was started around it always failed within a year. I mean, I remember running into someone, this would have been probably like seven or eight years ago. And again, someone had bought politics.com and was starting up a company. And I was talking to this nice woman who worked for them at a conference. And I'm like, okay, just so you know, the last three times this has been done, they didn't last a year. Yeah. But no, you know, I got a few offers here and there, but I'm like, this is a valuable name. I'm going to sit on it. And in the meantime,
is it for sale now? What's your price?
Everything's for sale. Just depends on how much money somebody has. To feed myself like everybody else did back then, who was in the .com world, built websites. And I ended up gravitating toward the nonprofit space. We also had another startup, a targeted search engine for politics and policy, which did pretty well for a year or two until Google got good, right? Yeah. There was a whole industry, briefly, of niche search engines. Yeah. But they all went away when Google got good.
Were you still in North Carolina at this time?
Oh, no. I've been up here a couple of years.
So was there something, a project that brought you to D.C. or just a change of
opportunity? It was, Raleigh was going nowhere.
Wanted to go into the heart of it.
Yeah, and I knew people in D.C. and there was work to be done here. So I moved up to do it. And I've been working primarily with nonprofits. I've done a little corporate work, like I said, some political work, but primarily nonprofit advocacy work ever since.
Mm-hmm. Okay, what's next for Colin Delaney? You're having a webcast next Thursday, in the past, if you're listening to this now, unfortunately. maybe people will be able to go on and get the archive for a couple bucks.
We'll see. It's up to Beth. Beth Becker is the driving that train. I'm just along for the. I'm there for a comedic relief as much as anything else. But hopefully, by the time you hear this, I'll be pretty far along on updating the digital campaigning guide, which, as far as I've ever seen, is the most comprehensive guide to using the internet for politics that's out there.
And what does that mean, using the internet? So actually, if you are a practicing politician or campaigner
or advocate,
how you go about doing it, and it's just written like an encyclopedia, like
it's,
here's how you use
it's
Facebook
actually just chapter by chapter. It's okay. You know, like for instance, in this new version, I need to add I'm going to add a chapter on list building. Right, because I've alluded to list building in a lot of different places.
I'll give you the transcript of this podcast, and that'll be the audience segmentation chapter.
But, you know, there's like, so you start off the big picture. You know, what is the internet good for? Yeah. You know, then how do you actually, you know, choose your own strategy, build your own campaign? Then the basic technologies, websites, email, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Then, you know, sort of mobilization. Fundraising, social media, online advertising, data and analytics, wrapped up with a sample campaign plan at the end. Mm-hmm. And it's I first wrote it in late 2009, and I've just been updating it steadily ever since.
And you're now in your fifth reprint.
It's probably the fifth iteration, yeah. And I'll update it again in January.
You can get that on Amazon?
You can. Okay. You go to epolitics.com and follow the links. But the current version is How to Use the Internet to Win in 2014.
Okay.
The next version will be How to Use the Internet to Win in 2016. Because 2016 is a magic number.
Why is 2016 magic? What did I miss?
Presidential year.
Oh, okay. I thought there was an inside joke there that I was missing.
No.
Okay. How else can people get a hold of you?
Well, epolitics.com. On the Twitters, I'm at epolitics. And then just Google me and I'll show up.
Yeah. And I bet you're probably available to answer questions and help people out if they've got questions.
I'm always happy to chat.
How to manage their list and segment it, and if they need to hire a consultant.
Happy to help. Happy to talk.
How you feeling, Brian? Anything you want to say?
We got our hashtag now, Forecast Podcast.
Sweet.
Oh, a little self-promotion.
I figured that's a way, yeah.
We should put this at the beginning of the show.
Because no one's
listening right now.
If you have any questions for Colin or for us, or have topics you want us to cover and find someone to be on the show, you can either tweet at us at the Foresight Studios Twitter account, or just use the hashtag Forecast Podcast. And we're monitoring that, so we'll see your message come right across.
Okay, we'll have to see how that trends on Facebook.
Yeah.
All right, thanks a lot, Colin. I appreciate you stopping by.
Very happy. Thanks for the beer.
Cheers.